नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So I thought a little bit about virya. Virya energy in the Pali Suttas, our scriptures, the record of the discourses of the Buddha, appears in various places. No, it's like the one that I've introduced here, the five faculties, so natural faculty, of course, that you all have. You all have some energy, otherwise you wouldn't be here. It's also actually it's one of the elements, the four elements in what the Buddha calls the four roads to success, which are related, of course, to making an effort to achieve something, anything, whether it's spiritual or mundane. So that's similar, isn't it, then with the five faculties or the five powers. So again, fairly obvious, we need some energy, isn't it, if you want to get anything, achieve anything. And then also it appears in the seven factors of enlightenment. It's interesting there, it's the third factor. So it comes after investigation. With the seven factors of enlightenment, it starts with mindfulness, the starting place for practice. You know, you have to be present for your experience to even start to practice with it. And then naturally, the second factor, of course, then is investigation. If I'm present for my experience, then I can investigate my experience. And then supposedly, the development, on, as the Buddha formulates it, the fulfillment of the factor of investigation leads to energy. So energy comes from investigation. And that's related to the fact that we might say energy comes from interest. No? If you're interested, then we have energy. And interest that in the spiritual context, it's of course that's on the context of the Buddha's path, it's of course connected to investigation. We investigate because we are interested. So I come back to that. That's important to keep in mind. It's something, it's a theme that appears also repeatedly in the Buddha's discourses. And you might say energy, and that's related to interest, is connected to desire, in the broadest sense. Where our desire is, that is where our energy is. Where our desire is, that's where our interest is. And therefore, that's where our energy is. And that relates to a third concept or factor in this area, which is motivation. No, desire, energy has to do with motivation. If you've got desire, you're motivated. If you're motivated, we've got energy. We've got interest, we've got energy. So these all hang together. So that's, I think it's quite rewarding to contemplate that. Also in the context of that core structure of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths, because sometimes perhaps it's becoming less common, but there can be this unfortunate, perhaps simplistic translation of, the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha's teachings, where you have of course, the first noble truth is dukkha. So there's dissatisfaction or unsatisfactoriness, stress, whatever fits under that umbrella term, dukkha. And then the second one, crucial one, is of course very crucial one in the Buddhist approach, is precisely it's not just the metaphysical or ontological given that there is suffering and we're just going to have to put up with it, but at least the suffering that the Buddha was interested in, that he was talking about. And there's a cause for it. And if you look at the formulation in the Pali Suttas, then the Buddha always talks about the cause of suffering being tanha, which sometimes is translated as desire. No, he mentions three forms of tanha: kama tanha, which is at first approximation desire for sensuality, for experiences in the broadest sense, and then bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. Bhava tanha, it's like desire for becoming something, so it has to do with self-view. And then vibhava tanha, V is just the opposite, it's one in negative. So that's sometimes a little tricky if you just look at the original scriptures of precisely what the Buddha meant with that. Perhaps modern translation, which to me makes, or interpretation that makes a lot of sense to me, is just this, just the opposite of bhavatana, as much as we can kind of aspire to become something, you know, whether it's a successful businessman or an enlightened Buddhist monk, you know, or an enlightened layperson, you know, whatever you fancy. The vibhavatana would be the desire. It's a bit awkward translation of for unbecoming, isn't it? For not being. But you could also say, like, it applies, and that's important, you know, for spiritual practitioners, this idea of trying to get rid of things, maybe that I don't like about myself. Also, that can also be a motivation. There are desires, there is our energy, there's our motivation for spiritual practice, as much as a positive motivation of trying to become a better person, more spiritual or even enlightened, to get rid of my defilements, my bad habits. No, that can be in the form of vibhavatana. Now, then, of course, we immediately think, well, there's a problem here. Certainly, by the time we come to the Third Noble Truth, where the Buddha says, well, so the solution to the problem is, if tanha is the cause of suffering, you know, then things cease when the causes cease. So if we give up tanha, no more suffering. That's the Third Noble Truth, cessation of suffering through the complete abandonment of these three forms of tanha. So clever people, you know, like us, and then start to think, well, it's a bit of a problem here, because what does that mean? It means, like, as a good Buddhist, I shouldn't have any desires. Well, you try. Some people do try. Or it's slightly more sophisticated when we realize, well, it's about attachment. No, it's not really about desires, but attachment to desire. Ajahn Sumedho often talks about like that, the problem is attachment to desire. Then as a good Buddhist, I should be unattached. I should be detached, you know, and we try to be detached. Again, well, good luck. Often out of that comes, of course, a caricature of what the Buddha was talking about. You know, it's like if he takes this on as a project, it becomes just another personality view. We try to impersonate an unattached person. But actually, we just tend to deny what is actually really there, because obviously it's not that simple to give up either desire and even like just attachment to desire. So first correction here, from my point of view, at least, this is just, you know, that's the way I contemplate this. I think fairly much in line with like how my teachers, like Lungpo Sumedho, talk about it, is first of all, you have to see tanha actually literally means thirst. Desire is already a bit unfortunate, simplistic translation, you know, because desire is a very broad kind of thing. I like to think about desire as a general kind of realm of different things, like the topic that we're talking about, where our desires, our energy is. So interest is a form of desire. It's a mild form of desire. I'm interested in something. Enthusiasm is a form of that kind of energy. Thirst is a particular manifestation of that desire energy, which has an edge to it, isn't it? And I think it's not by chance that the Buddha used the term thirst here. Because like thirst for sensuality, for sensual experience, or thirst for becoming, it's desire with an edge, isn't it? Isn't a mild interest, like, oh, well, I'd be interested in a cup of coffee right now or whatever. But I'm thirsting for it means I really feel I have to have this. I need to have this, isn't it? You know, if I'm thirsting, it implies like, you know, if I don't drink for a while, I'm going to die, isn't it? This is a matter of life and death. So there's an edge to it, there's an intensity to it. And there's also, of course, where this thing of attachment, you know, comes in. Like another one of these many Buddhist models that the Buddha used, you know, the dependent origination, attachment, the Pali word upadana, in that chain comes after desire, after thirst, tanha, you know, tanha leads to attachment. So thirst, if it implies this kind of thing, whether I really need this, I think it implies this kind of attachment to my desire. So I really believe the message and it has an urgency to it. There's an urge behind it. I really need this. That's, I think, is why Lungpo Sumedho always points out the problem is not desire, because desire is something very natural. where our desires, our energy is. That's where our motivation is. Without desire, we're not going to do anything, isn't it? Some form of desire. So we have to be a bit careful there. But the problem is the attachment to desire. So Marissa said the attachment to our preferences or to the message of the desire. In this case, the thirst, which tells me if I don't get this, I'm really not going to be okay. No, I'm feeling a lack, and this sense of lack, there's like a hole in my being, which has exactly the shape of this cup of coffee or the apple or the new BMW or, you know, that person that I fall in love with or whatever. You know, I need this. I need it. So there's the things of a need about it. Without it, I cannot be happy. I cannot be content. So if I really believe that message, which desire then gives me, then I'm caught, isn't it? Then I'm attached, literally, I'm attached. You know, it's got me, like the farmer got his bull by the ring in the nose, isn't it? Can pull you around. It's going to take you where the desire tells you to go. And depending how urgent it is, how intense the belief and the energy, it might take us to really weird places, isn't it? And we might apply all kinds of means, no, including of very unwholesome means, which are very obviously going to lead to suffering. But the thing is, of course, this very process itself, as long as we really believe that, that kind of need, that kind of thirst, then literally we are attached to the world of manifestation of what of the content of our experience, of that we experience through our senses. That's being attached to the wheel of samsara. And that's why this is a problem. This is why, you know, the Buddha talked about that this is actually the cause of suffering in the broadest sense, not just because I might attach to unwholesome things or I might start to crave things and then just do things that lead me into trouble because I'm craving so much after something or so much belief that I need to get something at all costs. But because this itself is a restless movement which cannot come to an end. No, because anything that we can crave for or look after, any kind of experience, karma, the karma tanha, not karma, but, you know, karma tanha, sensuality. By nature, every experience is fleeting and is uncertain. You know, even if you get what we want, you know, it's not going to last. It's not going to give us a lasting satisfaction. It might give us a hit. And the sensuality, of course, we know the problem. There are many problems about it, of course, but it's usually, it just means you want more. You know, there's this law of diminished returns. You know, what at the beginning seemed, you know, was really exciting, then the next time you need a bit more of it or something more exciting because the second time you already know it, it doesn't feel so interesting anymore and so forth. It's a theme we can come back to this in more detail because that's really, you know, the hub where our suffering comes from that we need to investigate. The thing is here that's like there's the investment of our energy, which if that's our belief, leads to this kind of sense of need, which keeps us attached to things, experiences, or projects about becoming. And of course, becoming is also something that never ends. You know, we always can become something else. And actually, in case you don't know yet, also like unbecoming, you know, getting rid of. It just never ends. And there's always something else, you know, that is kind of bothering us. Or, you know, this whole project about perfecting yourself as a personality and not recommended. Yeah, I want to just complete about the saying. So the interesting is that this very term attachment, which is upadana in Pali, literally also means feeding. So it relates to thirst, of course. The Buddha used thirst, tanha, in the Four Noble Truths. He could also have used hunger, isn't it? It's very similar. And hunger, we relate directly to feeding, isn't it? So there you see, thirst or hunger leads to this attachment, which is attachment through feeding. That's those of you who are interested, you know, in the Pali Buddhism, we have this list of the, not the five faculties, but the five khandhas, which I'm not going to go into it now, but that's five khandhas, is one way the Buddha divided up the content of our experience, all the aspects of what we can experience. One system model he has is, talks about the five khandhas. So that's just our experience itself. But then for the unenlightened mind, the mind that's not free, he describes that what we experience is upadana khandha. So it means attachment to those five khandhas. No, that's just his way in Pali describing what I'm just talking about. It's through belief, attachment to our desire, our thirst, our hunger, means we are attached to the five khandhas through feeding. Upadana means feeding. It means our mind feeds on experience. Something you can relate to? So, I mean, that's like how this works, isn't it? If you learn about the Buddhism, I remember when I first read, you know, particularly also Theravada, Pali Buddhism, you know, the Four Noble Truths, now it sparked my interest to see dukkha, something we can usually identify in some way, the satisfaction, this ease in our life. And then the interesting bit, of course, oh, right, there's a cause. And the Buddha talks about this. The cause is that we insist on feeding on this experience, the content of experience, which inherently cannot actually satisfy our hunger. It's not possible. That's what the Buddha claims. Now it's for us to investigate, of course. That's the next step. But that's a model. So there, I think that's an interesting model to think, to contemplate our own experience, you know, see for yourself how in one way or another you feed on experience, always a thirst for more, something else. And remember, that's where our desires is, where our energy is, where our motivation is. No, that's where we go. And the Buddha says, well, if you follow that in terms of experiences, you go, you keep going, but you keep going like the hamster in the wheel. Of course, it's not going anywhere. No? And that's the wheel of samsara. The Buddha used this image because he borrowed it from the idea, the general idea at his time about the description of fire. Mm-hmm. Fire was described as being something that is feeding on its fuel. Right? So it got and therefore the flame of the fire is attached to the fuel, say wood. If wood is the fuel, the fire is defined by its fuel. If the flame is attached to the wood, then it's a wood fire. We call it a wood fire. No, if it's oil, it's an oil fire. So the nature of the fire is defined by the fuel. And because the fire feeds on the fuel, it's the flame, the fire is attached to the fuel. Now, if the fire goes out, means if the fuel burns out, like if you don't feed a fire and eventually it burns out, what happens to the fire? No, it goes out. Now we all know that's obvious. And so there are suttas where the Buddha talks about that, as people ask about it. So where does the flame go? Now we're saying, well, it's a funny question, isn't it? It doesn't go anywhere. It just goes out. It doesn't go west, east, north, south or something. It goes out. In the modern, materialistically colored view that we all kind of somewhat, of course, affected by, the way we look at nature, we tend to take for granted that it just means there isn't anything anymore, isn't it? The fire goes out means it's gone, no? If you look at the fire just as a materialistic thing, there's something that's stuff and then it's gone, it's finished. But we have to remember the Buddha wasn't a materialist. There have been materialists around at the time of the Buddha, but it wasn't the prevailing view on nature. And it wasn't also the prevailing view on the nature of fire. So that is actually not what this image implies. It's a bit more subtle. And I shall not go too far into that, because then we're back in the mystery. And that's, the Buddha left it also as mysterious. Because when the Buddha said about, and not just the Buddha, you know, like say Brahmins, you know, from the Vedic tradition, talking about the fire before the Buddha, had that same understanding. The fire going out, meaning, it means like, as Ajahn Jeff, Ajahn Tanisaro, American monk from who has got a monastery in California, he wrote a book about it, translating it as saying it's like the fire is unbound from its fuel. So therefore, it's not manifest anymore. But you cannot say it exists or it doesn't exist. None of our kind of, you know, linear logic is really supposed to apply. It's like it exists in a kind of form of potential in an unmanifest way. No. But of course, as soon as we even try to somehow put that into language, it becomes maybe possibly a little bit distorted. But it's something like that. And so the Buddha used that as an image to explain what happens to the mind that is freed. That's why he used that same image. Like the fire is attached to the fuel, by feeding on the fuel, so the mind, chitta, or human heart, or human mind, is attached to the world, to the five khandhas, through feeding on the five khandhas. Now, if the mind stops feeding on the five khandhas, It's not attached to the five khandhas anymore. And then the mind is unbound. It's freed like fire unbound. No. It becomes unmanifest, non-manifested. There's a Pali word for it, anidasana vijnana, which appears a few times in the suttas. So that's a mind that cannot be pinned down anymore. You can't say about such a mind that it exists or it doesn't exist, and you cannot trace it because it's not feeding on anything. It doesn't leave any trace. No? The Buddha sometimes described in the suttas, because he had these psychic powers, of being able to trace a mind of somebody who has died. And people would ask him, well, where did this person, this mind, this chitta, where was it reborn? You know, where did it manifest after the body died here? And usually the Buddha would say, oh yeah, this person, you know, he was a good practitioner, or, you know, he really understood my teaching. He's been reborn in some heavenly realm, or maybe he's been reborn as a human being, or other things. But with an arahant, say, somebody or a mind that's completely liberated, the Buddha would say, you cannot say, because it doesn't leave any trace. It's unbound. It's not, because you would see the trace of the mind that manifests again through what it feeds on. You know, like to translate it into a Western context, you would say like the mind of an angel, and it feeds on different things than a human mind. You know? If you're reborn in a heavenly realm, then you feed on different experiences than a human mind. And you can trace the Buddha, you know, if you've got this power, then you can trace the mind depending on what it feeds on. If it doesn't feed anymore, it's not manifest. You cannot say anything about it. It's beyond language. So that was a little excourse into the mysterious realm of the ultimate. But here I just ventured into that to explain, so then to say that desire itself is not necessarily the problem. It's the attachment to desire, which binds us to existence. It binds us to the five khandhas. Literally, that's attachment, if you believe that. Desire is a natural energy that is there that motivates us. So that's the topic here, energy, isn't it? If you just try as an unenlightened person to say, you get the idea, well, not to have any desire, well, I mean, you're probably not going to succeed anyway. You might be repressing desire, and then it just goes weird, or denying it. But if you abandon desire, it's probably not going to lead you to freedom. It's probably going to lead you to depression, isn't it? That's one definition of a person who's depressed. It's not motivation goes. You're not motivated to do anything. You don't have any desire. You're not motivated. And you're literally not going to do anything. But that's not the freedom the Buddha was talking about. So the fourth noble truth that is then actually one that explains or gives a model of what the Buddha proposes of what to do with this energy of desire or even thirst or hunger, which keeps producing trouble for us. Because that's a path, as it's sometimes described, a path of purification. No. So I think it relates to the thing that we want to be careful about our desire. So the first step for the good Buddhist is not to try and pretend to not have desire or not to be attached, but to really acknowledge, to be aware of desire and what it does to you and how it motivates you, and to be aware of attachment. The Buddha didn't say you shouldn't be attached. You don't find that in the suttas. The Buddha said attachment leads to suffering. Where there's attachment, there's going to be suffering. Where there's suffering somewhere, there has to be attachment, you know, as a cause below it. And that's something that the Buddha invites us to investigate. Just see that for yourself. Become wise about it. You know? That's why the direction of the Buddha's path is towards wisdom, is towards investigation. So the Buddha says, take an interest in this. You know? Not try not to have it, but try to understand it. No, it's this understanding which comes through investigation, which needs interest, which needs motivation, which needs desire, which leads us to actually freedom of desire. And freedom of the desire doesn't in the first place here mean not to have desire, but means the freedom that we can experience the desire, but not having to be obliged to follow its message. No? We just know this is desire. It's like this. That's what awareness does, isn't it? That's what it does naturally. You don't even have to make it up or create it or work hard to actually get that faculty going. It's there all the time. That's what awareness does. Awareness is just aware. If you got a desire, no, when the desire for eating something, then I actually know, in another way, that I don't really need something. I might just be bored or something. It's a desire. I know there's still a piece of chocolate cake in the fridge, and I just haven't got anything more interesting to do, nothing kind of that, you know, I get a bit bored, motivated. Then suddenly these things can come up, isn't it? It gives you some energy, motivation, makes you feel alive. At least you've got a project, you know, go into the kitchen, get this chocolate cake, it's going to feel good. And, you know, it's nothing morally wrong with that either, no? But it's a good point to just illustrate this principle, no? Awareness, all that awareness does for you is it knows, well, there is desire. Heidi Ho, very good. You've seen it. Good, good. You know, a moment of mindfulness. You're mindful of desire. And of course, awareness gives you the ability to feel how it feels to desire this chocolate cake. No, whether it's a mild interest, could be, no, or whether it's a really burning desire, this belief that if I don't get this chocolate cake, something really bad is going to happen tonight. I might go crazy or whatever, or I might starve or collapse, you know, of exhaustion or whatever. My mind tells me if it does support and belief into the message or the desire. And then what the luxury that awareness gives us, it gives us opportunity to just stop there, just be aware of the desire. Instead of believing that I'm going to have to go fulfill the desire, have my preference met so that I then can be content, or believe that I'm then going to be content, why not just be content with the desire? No, we can do that. We know that sometimes we can do that. We can understand the principle, isn't it? And then if I put that into practice and I don't follow it, I can sometimes. Sometimes we mess it up in funny ways, but sometimes it works. And then actually, I mean, it's certainly that's my experience. And I see afterwards, oh, I feel good about it. I experienced some inner freedom. I had this desire, I didn't follow it. It gives me some authority, isn't it? That feels good. And that's the authority of awareness, if you can abide in it, if it becomes a refuge. Now, this is taking refuge in the Buddha. And that increases our faith in that possibility, the capacity of awareness to act as a refuge, that I can just be content being here, being present with whatever it is. Of course, the Buddha's claim is there's no limit to this, no? Because the true lasting self-sustained source of well-being is somewhat mysteriously inherent in this quality of awareness, presence itself. And also, according to the Buddha, the way to suffering is the mind, the awareness, the citta, the heart, moving out of itself, believing in the world of appearances, of things, of experiences, and grasping, holding on to them, looking for happiness, believing in happiness there. But then you're attached and you're on the wheel, on the Ferris wheel or the hamster wheel or the wheel of samsara, you're going around and around and around. The way to ease and true lasting peace of mind is exactly letting go. So the mind stays at home, or it comes back home. It stays home. It doesn't come out. It stays, if you like, in the center of the wheel. No, it's still. And if this would just be plain, well, you know, the kind of the desire, that desirelessness that we might imagine, if you don't know anything else for motivation in our life, then our, say, sensual desires or desires for becoming, then we're saying, well, that would be actually boring. I mean, who would want to be enlightened or free? It's just all the fun is gone in life, isn't it? I just go with what's left. But it is, of course, worthwhile, because this is apparently, you know, accompanied by a mysterious kind of plenitude, isn't it? This desirelessness for appearances, for becoming, or for things is possible because the mind can let go of those obsessions or, I mean, even mild interests, by coming back home into just being aware. And when we do that and we can experience this for ourselves, out of that, you know, it's not a bored kind of contentment. I'm just bored about the world. But there's a sense of inner plenitude, a source of inner well-being, which is completely independent of the circumstances of our life, which is a source of joy and of ease and energy, in fact. If we don't invest our energy in running after things, it releases a lot of energy, which comes out of, well, to me, certainly mysterious place. It's not, you know, something that I kind of created in a somehow spiritual gym or something by doing exercises. It just suddenly becomes available. It's like it's beyond self. It's beyond me. It's just something that fills you out, buoys you, you know, carries you. So that's always where to go is where to go from here. Where to go from here is like if you come back a little bit to the slightly more mundane aspects of the spiritual path. No, this might just sound very grand to us, just an idea. It might make sense at some point. If we just talk about the first three noble truths as a possibility, or we might take this on faith, or we might have had some of this kind of experiences, isn't it? Which usually comes as a surprise. Whether it's a small experience, which maybe makes still more sense, you know, when I notice, okay, I give up my insistence on having my breakfast egg cooked just the right kind of, you know, 3.5 minutes, not too hard, not too soft. And, you know, if it's too hard or too soft, then I'm really going to be discontent and have a quarrel with my partner, whoever made the egg, you know, or the hotel that I booked in, which should know better. So this thing, if I notice, well, this is something that I'm doing. If I don't insist, I have got more peace of mind with those little things. That makes sense. Sometimes, particularly if you start meditating, sometimes these things happen, of course, also apparently spontaneously, without obvious conscious effort. And deeper experience of letting go of some attachments to aspects of self, of self-view, of life projects, and you suddenly notice the relief that can come with that, and the liberation of energy that might come with that. We might then get inspired and get an inkling about what maybe the Buddha was on about, and that there might be actually something to it, which is interesting for us to explore and go deeper. But we will quickly probably find out that it's not that easy to sustain. Now, often we have some initial successes that inspire us, give us faith, no? And then for most people at some point it starts, you know, progress stops being that smooth and easy. And there might be long stretches where we just don't seem to be able to move anyway. We just continue to be same old boring or annoying person with all those bad habits that luckily, you know, not that many people know about. You know, most of them we can keep secret for ourselves. But, you know, all this even small ones was just impossible to overcome. And that's the thing, even like with anger reactions that we have, you might just see through it at some point, be able to let go and feel the relief of it. But that doesn't mean that we have dealt with anger for the rest of our life, as you all know, because habits go deep, and some of them are very, you know, deep also in biological conditionings. So we need to keep practice with those things, look into them, investigate, looking deeper. And for that, we need energy, isn't it? So that's why energy is one of those important factors that appear again and again in the Buddhist teaching, and is connected to investigation. So the energy hopefully comes from having had a taste, and therefore a wholesome desire is sparked. No? The desire for personal improvement, for insight, for peace of mind, for samadhi, whatever, you know, your spiritual good things that you can desire. And that's why the fourth noble truth is a path of purification. So what the Buddha basically suggests is if you don't just try and just get rid of desire straight away and then become spiritually depressed, we try to become wise about desire. So we acknowledge desire, saying like a good Buddhist shouldn't just try to be detached, but should be honest about the fact that I experience desires. Not all of them are very presentable to in public. And we have all our attachments. A mind that is underlined is naturally attached. It's sticky. You know, things, ideas, experiences, views, as if by magic, just stick to it. And it's very difficult to unstick them. But we can be honest about it. So then, as one of my teachers says, we start suffering responsibly. Right? That is the first step. What does it mean? It means we don't blame the world for our suffering or the people. We now, ultimately, we are responsible for our suffering. No, the world is unfair. Other people are bad. No, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, there's whether we suffer about it or not, there's certainly a very large part has to do with our way of dealing with that. And that has to do with this attachment to our ideas, how the world should be, how other people would be, attaching, insisting on those ideas. If my partner is not going to change to be the way that I think they should be, then I'm going to suffer. Fine, you're free to suffer. But at least if we acknowledge that something that comes from our insistence, then I don't have to blame my partner because they're just the way they are. They might be a lazy slob. And yes, they could be better. But whether I make that my problem, I might feel very righteous about it and have all, you know, the right in the world of making the problem. And my best friend also agrees with me and so forth. And my self-help book agrees with it. It's all fine, but it's still something that I'm insisting on. And as much as I'm insisting on it, the more I insist, the more I'm going to suffer. No? It's something that I can understand. So it's about suffering responsibly. And then the Buddha says, take an interest in that. Of course, hopefully then we are motivated because we desire to overcome suffering. We desire not to suffer. If I don't have that desire, I'm not really getting interested in Buddhist practice. No? So we need desire. In fact, we need all the energy that is in our desire, all our desire energy we need in order to be liberated. We cannot afford to dismiss any of that because desire and the energy in desire that is just suppressed or denied, it's desire that's lacking, that's missing. No, we need to actually that desire, but then we need to direct it in a way that's actually helpful to us. So the practice is, first of all, to find out, well, where is my desire? Where is my attachment? What can I do about it? How can I actually redirect this energy, this desire energy, in a way that is actually helpful rather than creating trouble for myself? And that, of course, can be a creative, and usually it's a slow and sometimes painful process where we learn from a lot of mistakes. You know, we don't learn that from, you know, overnight. No. But that's the thing. That's why the prime category, you know, that's a good thing to remember in the Buddhist teaching, you know, that he harps on about again and again. It's not emptiness or not self or, you know, those are kind of, yeah, some of these lofty things we can come in the end. But it's wholesome and unwholesome, kusala and akusala, appears again and again in the suttas. That's what we should contemplate. Now, what is actually wholesome and what's unwholesome? So what is actually a worthy object for my desire? Desire, the Buddha defines as wholesome, unwholesome, in terms of its nature, so how intense it is, or whether it's, you know, goes together with attachment or not, no? And or what the object it is. There are wholesome objects for desire and there are unwholesome objects for desire. No? And what is helpful in the sense of wholesome for you also, this doesn't always have to be the same thing. It might also change, of course, over time with the paths. You know, as you do probably progress in some way or another, you know, what might have been helpful at one point, you know, replacing a really unwholesome desire with something that's a bit more wholesome, you know, to get you out of some really harmful attachment, you might actually be able to take back that energy by investing it in something else, which is a little bit less harmful. And that would be a useful step rather than being idealistic and thinking just to be able to give up everything, all your attachments altogether. If you haven't got anything else to fall back on, that's very difficult, isn't it? No. So it's easier, and the Buddha actually explicitly talks about it. We give up, the intelligent person gives up a lesser satisfaction, a lesser pleasure for a greater pleasure. Greater doesn't here mean just more intense or more fantastic. It just means more refined, more wholesome in the Buddhist sense. No? Behind that is this acknowledgement that, of course, our mind is motivated by pleasure. That's not wrong, no? That's not bad. So as a Buddhist, you shouldn't just abandon all pleasure. You should just be careful about and investigate. You see what happens if you get attached to it. It leads to suffering. It means we try and start to manage this energy more skillfully. I come back again to one of my source teachers who very skillfully actually explained to me that a lot of practice is just damage control. Damage control. You know, that's a good word for, particularly for young, not so many of you are kind of young, male, inspired practitioners full of testosterone. I'm looking to Renaud here, just who wants to become a monk. And so I don't know him that well yet, so I don't want to assume anything. But I know there's a lot of young men coming to the, like me, many years ago, coming to the Sangha, often have this kind of overblown and overconfident ideas about practice, about, you know, how I'm really just put everything into it, like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, you know, if the bones dry up or the blood dries up, the bones crumble to dust, you know. Unless I achieve my goal, I'm not going to move. And we can do a lot of harm to ourselves if we attach to those kind of idealistic ideas. That's a good corrective that grows on you after a while with practice, I think. Also, my teacher told me that, look, you know, Abhinanda, be a bit more modest. A lot of practice is actually just damage control, because that's what awareness, if you cultivate awareness, does for you. It can be very humbling, isn't it? You start to notice more and more, you notice more and more of your little, of your limitations and the, as I said, not so presentable kind of desires and attachments that we have. And then just realize, you take this serious and you say, well, you know, there's a lot of stickiness in there which can potentially cause a lot of harm, because we all share the human condition. No? I mean, you just look at the news, what happens to human beings like us if they're in a less fortunate circumstance. We don't know how we would react, you know, in more extreme situations. So that's important, you know, that humbles ourselves, but also makes us alert to the fact that human beings are dangerous creatures. Now, we've got an enormous potential for good and beauty, as well as a good enormous potential for creating harm, because we are so sophisticated both ways. So then a lot of the praxis, and that's what precepts we talked about in the first evening, you know, the precepts, the commitment, that's one of the reasons why so fundamental in the Buddhist approach is the commitment to an ethical impeccability, ultimately, you know, it's a foundation of practice. You know, it's an awareness of the potential harm that can come from this one, you know, the power of this mind, you know, for creating harm. Don't be negligent about it. Don't be oblivious about the voice. Not is it, are the other people or the bad ones? I would never do that. No, that complacency can get into trouble. No, so damage control means you have this modesty. I take responsibility for my attachments, for my desires, and take care of them. So that's why a lot of the precepts on ourselves about restraint. You know, we try to restrain ourselves. We abandon unwholesome desires. So the chocolate cake in the fridge is not such a big problem for a start, you know. We're taking first of the care of the more obvious things first that creates a bit into trouble. And so that means gradually we recuperate more and more, you know, as we don't follow our desire and energy always outwards, we can recuperate more and more of this energy and becomes available for investing into the path, into cultivating wholesome qualities like kindness, compassion, generosity, and for investigation. And so energy with desire then over the past gets gradually purified. And I hope, you know, it is an experience that we all in some way kind of share. Sometimes it can be frustratingly slow, because also by modern people we tend to be very impatient. Patience is not one of the qualities that we've got most developed, you know, because the whole modern culture is geared towards instant gratification, isn't it? And then so we easily think things have to be, need to results quickly. And then also we often have an overblown inner critic. Critical mind is something that serves us very well for seeing where things can be improved. So it's a great aid in all kinds of progress, but it can also backfire in the way that we always niggling, isn't it? If the inner critic really runs the show, then we are in trouble, isn't it? Because it's always focusing on the things where we are not good enough yet, where we are failing. And we often actually overlook the science of where we actually are improving, you know, all the time. I mean, we can see that how gradually we become a bit more free, a bit more easeful. Mm. So attention on our energy, where we invest our energy in daily life, you know, in the moral, ethical realm, is a very important aspect of that. I just mentioned, without getting too much into it, a couple of aspects more and how this manifests then in the suttas. One is, of course, in the Eightfold Path, energy appears as the sixth factor, which is right effort. It's not energy, virya the word, it's vayama there, but they are very closely linked and connected, sometimes seeming almost kind of used interchangeably. Like when the Buddha talks about energy, he illustrates it by talking about effort. And it is always the same formulation, always, wherever in the suttas, it's always about making the effort to cultivate and maintain the wholesome kusala, wholesome states of mind. Mm. To make the effort to bring into existence wholesome states of mind that are not here yet. And of course, the opposite, the effort to abandon unwholesome states of mind. And the effort that's necessary to actually try to make sure or to prevent those unwholesome states of mind that we have abandoned to reappear. Well, this is just a standard formulation. How the Buddha speaks about how this works, you know, it's a formula where we invest our energy in our practice. You know, we can apply that to any kind of elements or factors on the path. And another thing in meditation, with the five faculties, as you remember, there is this aspect where energy needs to be balanced by samadhi. So that's also to say, so energy, if practice, interest, if you get interested in that, if you've got some good experiences about it, and then we have this positive energy going, like enthusiasm, the Buddha used this word, Dhamma Chanda, enthusiasm for the Dhamma, we can motivate a lot of energy, but it needs to be balanced to be really useful. It needs to be balanced by samadhi, which samadhi here means just, you know, in the most general sense, some collectedness of attention, some steadiness and continuity of attention. Because if not, as we know, energy just leads to a lot of, to enthusiasm, leads to a lot of, could be, if it doesn't have samadhi, uncoordinated activity, you know, you just might be restless, you know, how physical restlessness feels, or just takes us to a lot of thinking, you know, can't stop thinking all those beautiful spiritual ideas. And after a while, it's just exhausting, isn't it? It doesn't lead you anywhere. So this also to do, of course, with the skillful steering use of energy in spiritual practice. To see that it's not just about the more energy, the better, or the more effort, the better, and the effort, you know, to cultivate skillful states of mind, to abandon skillful states of mind is, of course, not just blood, sweat, and tears kind of effort. It can be very subtle. You know? The famous canonical image that the Buddha used was this thing about tuning the strings of a lute. You know? There was a disciple of the Buddha who got inspired about the Buddha's teaching. So he got very enthusiastic. So he got a lot of energy going. He had a really, really strong desire to become free from suffering. So he really went into practice and he did a lot of walking meditation, like I hope you did this afternoon. But he was he used to come from a very refined background. And the way the suttas say it is like he was from a rich family and his parents pampered him so much that actually when he grew up as a child and a young man, his feet never touched the ground because he was always carried around in a, you know, like in this, you know, he was always carried on, you know, his seat, you know, like a princeling. He was so inspired, he became a monk and he went straight to practice and he did walking meditation. He heeded what actually Ajahn Chah's advice was to his monks in his monastery. He sometimes would go around in Wat Pa Pong, his monastery in Thailand, you know, to check how the monks were doing, and you would, and partly what he would look at is like how clean and tidy they would keep their kuti and the space around it. And if I remember correctly, he would pay attention to the walking path. You know, and he would say, you know, as good monks and nuns, in fact, there were also nuns in his monastery, you should always have a nice and tidy walking path which is swept clean, not only by your broom, but even by your feet, because you're doing a lot of walking meditation. I think he even was one time he said, actually, there should be a trench in your in your walking path, you know, from your walking back and down all the time, you know. And so this monk at the time of the Buddha, he took that literally and he started doing walking meditation, but his feet were very delicate. So he actually, his walking path didn't just have a trench, but it was covered in blood, you know, from his delicate feet. But he didn't, as maybe predictable by all this trying just to put in more effort, because it wasn't wise effort, it wasn't balanced effort. It didn't take him to enlightenment. It did take him, like it, I've seen it with a lot of over energetic and enthusiastic young monks, novices, it took him to frustration and despair. You know, I put everything into this and it obviously doesn't get me anywhere. Obviously, this is not for me. As happens nowadays in the modern era as well, then sometimes a mind like that goes from one extreme to the other. So you think, oh, this just all doesn't work. And you just go back to, you know, to the total opposite. You just give up all your aspirations. And so was this young monk in the time of the Buddha. His name was Sona, Bhikkhu Sona. He wanted to disrobe. He just got disheartened, wanted to disrobe and go back to his family. And the Buddha, you know, realized that this was happening and he paid him a visit. And so he gave him a teaching about right effort, you know, where he basically was telling him, it's not just about, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. He reminded him about his youth, like, as you know, as a princeling, he would play a lute. And he asked him, you know, when you would tune your lute, you know, if you tighten the strings too tightly, would the lute sound nice? And he said, no, you know, it would just go, and maybe even the string would break, which is basically what happened to, or was about to happen to the Venerable Sona. He said, oh, what if you don't tighten it, you know, enough, would the lute sound nice then? He said, no, it just goes, no sound comes out at all. So right effort, you know, in that sense, just means you just have to tune it just right, you know, so it's not too tight and it's not too loose. You know? And luckily, as it always happens, much easier, of course, in books that we read, you know, because Sona got the message and he got it right. He stayed as a monk and he actually, you know, he realized Nibbana. But he adjusted his effort, you know, he just has to be just right, you know. And like in meditation, you know that, you know, if you're really trying hard to get concentrated, you just get a headache, isn't it? It's just not, it doesn't work. But if you don't do anything, you just sit there and go, well, you know, effort doesn't work for me, so maybe I just gonna have to wait until enlightenment comes to me. It's not gonna work either, isn't it? So it's almost a koan. This is quite interesting. You don't get to enlightenment through effort, but you don't get there without effort either. You know, you're just gonna have to make your contribution, and you know, just tune the mind just right until things really start to happen by themselves. You can't make them happen, you know, but you can invite them, you know, if you tune the energy. So that's something that I often use myself for contemplation, investigation, second factor of enlightenment. Informal meditation is to look at my meditation in terms of energy. What is the quality of energy right now like? Is it too tight or is it too loose? If you gauge your meditation in that sense, then it gives you an information about which way to tune the effort. No? Do I need to raise a bit my energy? Or do I need to somehow find ways of relaxing a bit more, becoming a bit more calm? And you see, but in there is a whole subtlety of energy and right effort. Because if you have this, if you have a criteria like this, through which to assess our meditation, we are investigating. It means we're taking an interest. And out of interest comes energy, naturally. And that's the energy that Buddha is talking about. It's not the energy of, you know, going in there with idealism and a big mission. It's the energy that comes from interest, taking an interest, paying attention. You know? And we start to see things. And the motor starts to tune and hum kind of nicely. You know?